the promises of Christ the Lord. Bound to Him eternally by love's strong cord. Overcoming daily with the Spirit's sword. Standing on the promises of God. Standing, standing, standing on the promises of Christ my Savior. Every moment to the Spirit's call, resting in my Savior as my all in all, standing on the promises of God, standing, standing, standing on the promises of Christ my Savior, standing, standing, I'm standing on the promises of God.
In the West, there are still a few good men left, men of God, like the circuit-riding preachers of old, proclaiming truth like the holy prophets of old, strong and bold. You're about to hear politically incorrect, but biblically correct truth from circuit-riding preacher Peter Peters, whose home base is a radio ranch nestled in the Laramie River Valley near Laramie, Wyoming. The Radio Ranch is a working cattle and horse ranch where circuit riding preacher Peter Peters broadcasts nightly worldwide on the Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network, reaching the world through satellite, radio, television, shortwave, and the World Wide Web. Riding for the brand, he preaches for the man, Jesus Christ, the Son of God. His circuit not only includes a radio ranch outreach in Wyoming, but also the LaPorte Church of Christ, located at the base of the colorful Colorado Rocky Mountains in LaPorte, Colorado, where he has preached for over 30 years. The messages preached there by Dr. Peters on Sunday morning are streamed live on the internet and are archived at the ministry website, scripturesforamerica.org. Dr. Peter's politically incorrect but biblically correct sermons are available on CD and DVD. Many in America, Canada, and all over the world are on the free CD and DVD ministry. Our address will be given at the end of this broadcast. And now, here is Dr. and Pastor Peter John Peters with the Word of God.
Yeah, I guess I better tell you what I did there. It's like one of those Picassos that you really won't believe it by looking at it. Yeah, but you seen me do it before. That's what it is. Is that right, huh? What's that? Oh, what do you mean it looks terrible? That looks exactly like what it's supposed to look like. The beauty is in the eye of the beholder, yeah. Oh, gone. You know, I tell you, you know art critic, I can tell that. you just tell me when you're ready. You all ready to go? Well, this part of my talk is going to be Wolves and Sheep, Part 3. And it's going to be about the Goths, your granddaddies. They are the East Germans. And this is their history. It's not in the history books anymore, but you know about Gothic architecture, and they'll show you this big church and say, that's a Gothic church, or this is Gothic this or Gothic that, and you don't know what the dickens they're talking about. Gothic, Goth, means dark. The word gut, or good in German, comes from God's people. These people, now this is, such as it is the map of Europe. This down here is Africa, and this little old squinched up thing here is Europe. This is the Baltic. This is England, or Britain, and Ireland. So you're going to have to use your imagination, but you do, you know, with any real true work of art. Now, the Goths, according to the Roman historians, they lived right up here in the northern part of Europe. They lived over here in Sweden. They lived over here in what is now Finland. They lived over here in what is now Denmark. They lived over here is where Poland, northern part of Poland is, Danzig. And they were extensive. The land was pretty well settled. Now, the land was overcrowded according to the history books. So according to the history books, the king went among the people and told the younger sons they're going to have to get, because there wasn't any room, because the land could not be divided. So they'd have to go to land, vacant lands, and they're going to have to pick up their own land. So what they did was this. Oh, laws and me, I left out a couple of things I got to put in. Now, they said that way down south is vacant land. And it's in the south part of Russia next to the Black Sea. Now, this is Europe here, Africa. This is the Atlantic Ocean. Now, what they could do is this. They could get in these ships, which look remarkably like dragon ships. You couldn't tell the difference. The reason they were look like dragon ships is they used them on the rivers. They used them on the rivers of Russia. And I'll tell you why in just a second. And these rivers were shallow draft boats. And what they would do is they each had a single mast, and they had rowers. And they would hang their shields on the outside of the bulwarks of the ships. And in front they had a dragon, sure enough. Now these people, they haven't connected it yet, but in my opinion are the granddaddies of the Vikings. But anyway, they had to come down to this area right here. This is the area of the Black Sea. All the land is just as rich as anything you ever saw, and nobody lived there. So what they did, they had a choice. They could take their ships, and they could go out here into the Atlantic Ocean, go through the North Sea right here, come all the way around Spain, go up through the Mediterranean Sea, sail all around here, go up through this area here into the Black Sea, and they could do that. Now, that'd be about 4,000 to 5,000 miles. Or, now I'm going to tell you something that most of the historians are not going to tell you, but you get a map yourself and look it up, because I'm telling you what the history books say. They got these rivers here in Europe. They got the Vistula, and here they got the Rhine River. Goes back in here. Now, let me tell you a little something else. In the Black Sea, they got this river here that goes all the way up in here. It comes about a mile and a half away from this river. They got another river that cuts out right here, goes all the way back up here and cuts over here. There's another river that almost touches it. Right here, the Rhine River comes all the way back here, and guess what? Have you ever heard of a river called the Danube River? It comes about a mile and a half or 2 miles away from the Rhine River. So in other words, now you pay attention to what I'm telling you, because this is how it was. You could go up that Rhine River. You could put that doggone boat on a cradle that got wheels on it, and you could get a couple of teams of oxen, and you could haul that doggone thing from one river to the other. It's only about 1,800 miles from here down to there if you use the rivers. You could pull it up this river, go over there, transfer right there, or transfer right there. Or there's another place you could transfer like that. There are about four places you could transfer and pull that boat on over. Now, this wasn't unusual at all, because these people called the Goths had been doing this for a long, long time. This is where they traded. They traded back and forth. They traded for skins. They traded for minerals. Traded for all sorts of things. And what they did, every time the river forked, every time there was a fork in the river, you would find a settlement of Goths. These settlements of Goths were scattered all over Russia. Everywhere the river forked, there would be a village. Every time place there would be a portage where they pulled the ships from one river to the other, there'd be a village. Russia was loaded with Goth villages. So when they started out, it wasn't like they hadn't done it before, because they had been doing it for... Now look. This word Goth, it's in the Roman history books at about 100 B.C. I have since run across the name Goth in the area of Mesopotamia down here that goes back to 3800 B.C. The Goths have been around for a long time, and they have gone back and forth across those rivers just like that. And they thought no more of going from the Mediterranean and the Black Sea up these Russian rivers and over into the Baltic than that. It's no big deal. My granddaddy got here in 1615, Bartholomew. He was 15 years old. He must have traveled back and forth across the Atlantic Ocean 20 or 30 or 40 times. He had an office in London. He had an office down there in Jamestown. I think our granddaddy's probably traveled a whole lot more than we do. Now, I'm just telling you from what I know. Now, look. When they left this area right here, they got on these rivers, and they started down here. And it wasn't done overnight. It was done over a 100-year period. And gradually, this area here started filling up with Goths. And how did it do? The land is to be divided, never ever to be sold. And what happened? It went down there, and each person set up his own farm. They built their own barns, outbuildings. They had the little trading centers like you all always did. They were wealthy, healthy people. Okay. One of the daddies here asked me to throw something in, and I had to do it. So, I was raised on a farm, and so far as I know, I never heard of a divorce. I guess there were divorces, but I never heard of one. I tell you, a man needs a woman on a farm. And I know for goodness, I know sure that a woman needs a man on a farm. There's 10,000 things that have to be done right now, if not yesterday, and will you please help me? And children are wanted. The extra, when I was 7 years old, I fed the chickens, I slopped the pigs, I fed the cows, I cleaned out the stables, And I took all the kindling into the house. Went through four doors, and I dropped a couple of pieces of kindling at every door. I was 7 years old, 7, 8, 9, during that period of time. And I was not overworked. They were just my chores, see? And everybody's got their chores. Now, I got some opinions on things. Now, this is what they are. I've watched cattle, and I've watched horses. And I know there's a time when they come in season. And when they come in season, they act differently than the times they're not in season. I'll give you a little piece of information more. A man is in season from the time he's 13 years old until the time he's 85. Now that's the way it is, see? Now you can color it any way you want. But if a woman enters a room and a man is not acutely conscious that there's a woman in that room, he ought to be taken to a doctor and examined, because something is wrong with him. He'll be different from every man I have ever met, see? Now, a woman is different, and a woman thinks that men are like women, and they ain't. A woman thinks that she can play around, I mean the adolescent kids, with a man, and that a man has to be turned on like a woman, and that she can encourage a man to like her by, you know, putting her hands on him and being nice to him and things like that. Well, let me tell you, that's not exactly smart. A man is already in season. It does absolutely no good for a 16-year-old boy to date a 16-year-old girl. If they date, it's cute, it's sweet, it's nice. But sooner or later, that little girl is going to come into season. And when she does, and there's no chaperone, and there's no chaperone present, you don't know what is going to happen. The Lord himself put this urge in people. He put it there so the race would continue. This is his desire and his wants that he put in you and he put in me. And he put it there for a reason. And he also put a rule book down there to handle this thing. Yeah, don't allow adolescents to gather without a chaperone. It is far better to have a 14-year-old daughter of yours to go out with a 22-year-old man than it is to have her go out with a 16-year-old. Now, let me tell you why. A 22-year-old man is probably going to be able to care for a wife. A 16-year-old can't do diddly squat except sire a kid. And that's the last thing that you really do need at that age. Now, I'm deadly serious in this thing. There is no reason that I can see for boys and girls to go out before a man is ready to take care of a daughter. It is far better for the 22 or 25-year-old man to come paying court to your 17-year-old daughter than it is for your 17-year-old daughter to go out with a 17-year-old boy who's a boy. The scriptures state, men, establish your business before establishing your home. And you, as the mothers and fathers, are responsible that that little girl and that little boy doesn't get themselves in trouble. So I threw that in because the Goths had the same problem back there then. Now, I'm going to give you a little quick little geography lesson. All across North Africa is a great desert called the Sahara Desert. It runs all the way over here. Right here is the great deserts of Arabia. Right here are the Iraqi deserts. Right here are the Iranian deserts. Over here are the Gobi deserts. And over here is China. For years and years and years, the wolves have used these deserts. They'll slip over into the sands of the desert, and you never see them. You never hear of them. You don't know they're there. 1 mile back from the sea, 1 mile back, you never know anybody's in there. But there are people in there. There are villages in there. There are oases in there. And these are international travel routes with caravans of 200 camels any one of those camels would have been worth $1 million today. And they traveled back and forth through these great deserts. And that's where the wolves have gone. They think no more of traveling from the Atlantic Ocean to the Pacific Ocean, thousands of miles away, than my granddaddy thought about getting on a sailing boat down Jamestown, going back to see how business was on Fleet Street in London, and coming back. Just like that. Now let me tell you what happened. Over here, you've got these traders. They got these little wagons, and they got pots and pans hanging on them, and they go around selling this, that, and the other. They looked a little different, see, but they had things to sell. So they went to all these little villages around here, selling this and selling that, selling the other. Did a real good service to the people. They were gathering information. The wolves always have scouts, and every place you have sheep, you've got wolves. That's what wolves do. They eat sheep, and they can't eat sheep if they don't know where the sheep are and what they're doing. So, these traders got into the trade routes here, and they passed the word on that here in this area of the Black Sea were rich settlements with cattle and sheep, and they had all sorts of goods, and they weren't well defended, and they were all spread out, and they couldn't take care of themselves very well. Now, let's talk a little bit about the wolves. These wolves are all the same people. Sooner or later, they travel all the way over to China, and they look down at China over this wall, and they see all these rich cities. And boy, a wolf who sees all these rich cities, they just can't help themselves. They gotta go after them. So one after another, for hundreds of years, there's been one group of wolves after another group of wolves after another group of wolves go after the Chinese wolves. Now, the Chinese named each one of those invasions. One of those invasions they named the Turk invasion. Another one they named the Ottoman invasion. Another one they named the Khazar invasion. Another one they named the Mongol invasion. Another one they would name the Hun invasion. All the same peoples, but with different names. That is important. Don't be fooled by name. A person might belong to a different group, but he's a member of the same wolf society. Now, we know who we're dealing with. We know who the Arabs are. They are called loosely Arabs, if you want to give them a name, a generic name for everybody. They would all be called Arabs. Now, over next to China, we have a group of people that's just tried to invade China. They named them the Huns. And these Hun warriors were interesting people. They were fierce warriors. They rode little ponies. They were fast. They were armed with these bows. They were armed with a curved sword. They were armed with a lasso. They were armed with a whip. And this is how they operated, like a wolf pack. They wouldn't stand and fight as a general rule. What they would do is they would dart in and dart out. They'd try to make you come after them. If you left ranks and came after them, one of them would come off to the side and throw his whip around the horse's front legs. The horse went head over teacups. Another Hun would come up with his lasso and throw it. You think the cowboys invented the lasso? Well, let me tell you. They would throw the lasso over the head of the warrior on the ground and grab him and drag him to death. And that's how they worked it. And they used the javelin to come in and finish them off. And that's how they operated, like a wolf pack. They were very careful not to get hurt, though, if they could possibly help it. Because the greatest danger to a wolf is other wolves who will take his place. Now, the Hun tribal structure was this. You had an alpha wolf. And then you had a pecking order, and whatever he said went. He found out from these traders that they had a group of sheep called East Germans, Goths, God's people. They're living along the Black Sea. Two 1,000 miles away, virtually defenseless. So he ordered his men to load up on covered wagons. And they did. And they traveled 2,000 miles away to the Black Sea region. Now the Goths had never heard of the Huns. And they didn't know a Hun from an Eskimo. And all of a sudden, one morning, when the sun came up and the cock was crowing and the chickens were clucking and the cows were mooing, guess what came over the hills? A horde of wolves like the leaves on the trees from everywhere. And before you, there was consternation. They had never seen these people. And they were fierce of visage. They were awful looking, and they did terrible things to the prisoners they caught. Absolutely terrible things. And before you could say Jack Robinson, they had captured half of them. Half of the Goths were prisoners of the Huns. And the Huns put it to them. You serve us. You serve our soldiers. You serve as our soldiers when you want to. Or we're going to kill all your women and children. That's an offer you can't refuse. So they did. They were called the East Germans, or the East Goths, or the Ostrogoths. All the same thing. Don't get it complicated. You don't have to remember all the names. These were the East Germans, or the Ostrogoths. They were slaves to the Huns. The other half of them were Visigoths. And they got out as fast as they could. And they also did something else. They learned. They learned Hunnic ways. They learned the ways of the wolf. They all mounted themselves on horses. The javelin of the Huns, they doubled the length of it and became a lance. The Viking shield, they pulled it up on a horse. Huns had no shields. They kept the shield. They sewed metal plates on the Huns' armor. And all of a sudden, these Goths, the Visigoths, the East, the West Goths, started having metal plates on the armor to turn the Huns' arrows. They had metal helmets, like the Vikings always did. And they did something different. Instead of darting out like the Huns did and coming back, they learned to charge boot to boot. In other words, if the Huns would come in and they could trap a group of Huns in some sort of trap, they would then bring in the threshing machine. And that was a charge of mounted chivalry. The first time in history the knight, the Christian knight, was ever heard of. And speaking of Christians, over half of these Visigoths were Christians. As many Visigoths were Christians as Romans were Christians. The Visigoths had long ago sent down into this region, around Nicaea, and this region here, where the lost tribes went, to get missionaries to teach them. And there was a great argument between the Visigoths and the Romans over Christianity. And I'm not going to get into that, but I'm just telling you that the Goths were half of, as many of them were Christians as the Romans were Christians. Now, there were not as many West Goths, Visigoths, as there were Huns. And they had to get out of there or else be eaten alive. So they came all the way over here to this river. Remember, that's the Danube River. And that was the barrier. On this side is the Roman Empire. And the Roman Empire, by this time, this part of the empire was controlled by a city right here. It's called Constantinople. All the trade from these Russian cities across the Black Sea had to pass Constantinople. And Constantinople took a cut of all the trade. And they had great armies. Well, they got up to the Danube River and they said, hey, we've got to get across the Danube River because we've got these Huns at our back. And they said, if you will let us across the river, we will help defend the Danube River against the Huns who are right behind us. Because let me tell you, you don't want anything to do with those guys. Now, in that day and time,
the word of a German, the word of a Goth, God's people, was taken as law. It was known far and wide that if a German, a Saxon, or East Goth, or Visigoth gave his word, it was so, unless you broke your part of it, and then it nullified the treaty. All right, now here were the conditions they made. This land was all vacant, and the reason it was vacant is because it was taxed. All taxed land is sooner or later vacated. People leave the land that is taxed. That is always so. People get so much in debt that they take their land and nobody lives on it. I live in Lynchburg, Virginia. When I was a boy, there was every piece of ground between city limits and the Lux Mountain was farmed. Today, you can go between the city limits and Lux Mountain and there's not a piece of red mud that you can see. None of it's farmed. It has all been taxed. The farmers have been forced out. And if anything, they're speculating with the land, building subdivisions or something. But the farms are gone. It's been taxed. The same here. In Rome, no one lived on the land. They lived in the cities. You don't have cities except in wolf societies. When people are forced from the land, they have to go somewhere. And what usually happens is that they are stockpiled in cities. And instead of making their own way and sustaining themselves as kings and priests, they receive salaries. Now, their salary is a sign that you work for someone else, that you are not a king and a priest under the wolf society. That's why they really want to get the farmers off the land, in my opinion, one of the main reasons. They know our law. The second thing was that the Romans were to feed them for 1 year because they had no food. It would take them a year to put a plow in the ground and raise a crop. The Romans said, fine, we'll do that. We'll furnish you with a year's supply of food. In return, you can have this land up here to farm if you defend it against the Huns. So the Romans down here at Constantinople, they gave the money to buyers to buy food for the Goths, and the buyers took the money and put it in their pockets, and the Goths received nothing, and they were starving. A starving people have no choice. If they weren't being fed according to agreement, then they would take the food. So the Goths started south, and they went out in the countryside and to gather food to feed their women and children. They loaded their women and children in covered wagons, and they protected those wagons as they went in long wagon trains. Don't get the notion that wagon trains are something new to American West. We're talking right now about 385 A.D. The Romans panicked. They said, we're being invaded by Goths. So they sent the legions out to fight them. By that time, there were no Romans left. Remember, when you tax people, what happens is they have fewer and fewer children in order to save money to live on. Eventually, they have so few children that the population shrinks to virtually nothing. The population of the Roman Empire was located in all the big cities. The countryside was virtually vacant. In order to get anybody to fight for them, they had to hire them. And who did they hire? They hired the West Germans over here to Constantinople to fight for them. So you had a Roman army made up of Germans, West Germans, and you had the Visigoths, the East Germans. They headed right at each other. The Roman army fought the way Romans fight, in three lines. No, they used short swords. And the square Roman shield was a German behind it, but they fought in the Roman style. And they went in. Now, I don't know how many of you have ever fought in a ring, but you got three, in an amateur, you got three 3-minute rounds. And at the end of the third round, you are so exhausted you cannot hold your arms up. Now, fighting at full tilt, a man can't last more than 5 minutes. So the Romans were taught to fight full out with their sword darting out like the tongue of a snake. Their head right to the face of the enemy, just like that. And right over their heads, the javelin throwers in the back. Right over their heads would be throwing the javelins. And right behind that, the arrow throwers would be shooting. All of that, just like this. And in 5 minutes' time, they would be worn out. This man would turn his shield sideways. He would dart back. The next man would be, come up front. And he'd be fighting full speed for 5 minutes. Then the third line would come up. And he would be fighting full speed. In other words, whoever fought the Roman armies was fighting a fresh man. And no man can stand up to that very long. That was the secret of the Roman army. Nobody could stand up to the Roman army because of the way it was organized. And the Roman army had never been beaten, ever. It was invincible. They marched out. And then in the distance they saw these Goths. And when they saw the Goths did something strange. They took their wagons and they put them in a great big circle. And between the wagons, they posted their infantry, the East German infantry, the Visigothic infantry. The Roman legions marched up, but before they did it, the Roman legions sang their song. And that day and time, before they went into battle, they would sing the Barabbas, their great battle song. And the East Goths had never met the West Goths. The East Goths sang their battle song before the battle and asked God to help them. It would be something like a mighty fortress is my God, something to that before the battle. And the Roman legion marched up to the wagon, circle wagons, and stopped. They had never confronted wagons before. What do you do when you confront wagons? Underneath the wagons, they had boards that had fallen down to form a wooden board. They'd never fought anyone like that. They tried to go between the wagons, and there was infantry there. And they tried to go over the wagons. It was very difficult because they didn't have any ladders with them. They weren't prepared. They had been told by their scouts that there was nothing but infantry in front. And then, from behind the wagons, what happened? The first charge of Christian chivalry in history. The knights thundered out from behind the wagons. They had them right where they wanted them. They ran right over top of the lightly armed Roman cavalry and rode them right into the ground. Then they swung back and hit the Roman infantry from the rear and ground them up just like grain. In that battle, 3/4 of the Roman soldiers died. The Roman emperor died. 35 Roman generals died. The Battle of Adrianople. It was fought by our granddaddies. You've been using wolf tactics, and we destroyed the Roman army and left the doorway open to the Huns, who were right behind them. Now, the Huns crossed the river. They were now into Europe. They were now into the Roman Empire. Everything had to be done to try to contain the Huns. The Huns ranged all over this area. They took a big piece of land and occupied it, and they gave it their name, Hungary, the land of the Huns. You can go to Hungary to this day, and you see the people do not blush red. Most of them, they have some German settlers down there who do, but most of them, oh, you got some Slavs, but most of them are Hungarians. And they occupied another piece of land called Transylvania. And in this land of Transylvania, they had strange beliefs of werewolves and vampires. And the Huns believed these things about vampires and things and evil eyes, and these omelets to cast off the evil eye. That's where they come from. Hungary, Transylvania. Through the years, now this was 378. In only 3 years' time, from being absolutely defeated by the Huns, they had adopted a new way of warfare and had defeated the greatest army on earth in 3 years. When we finally decide on the method of that the Huns use against us, the wolves use against us, and we adopt it for our own use, I think we're going to see things a whole lot different. But we must study the wolf to learn what the wolf does. The warfare, understand? Okay. The warfare went in spurts all across southern Europe. There were a series of wars between Rome and these Huns. One of these Huns was a fellow named Attila. Now, Attila was one ugly boy. He was short, he was squat, he had slant eyes, and he had a pug nose, and he swaggered when he walked, and had a great big chest, and he looked like he owned the world. He acted like a pack leader. Now, at a very young age, he was exchanged to the Romans for good behavior of the Huns, and the Huns took back Roman hostages for the good behavior of the Romans. Now, that's what they did. If anybody broke the treaties, they would kill the hostages, see? So everybody tended to live up to their treaty agreements. Attila lived in the Roman court. He saw the Roman army. He saw the Roman system of taxation. He saw the Roman laws. He learned everything about Rome. The Roman German who was taken by the Huns was a fellow named Aetius. Now, Aetius was a smart fellow too, and he looked at the Huns, and he learned about Hun rules, Hun warfare, Huns system of transportation, Huns weapons. He learned the Huns tactics. Aetius knew everything that was possible to know about the Huns. He probably knew more about the Huns than the Huns knew about themselves. So this, we have an interesting situation developing. We have the potential now, when both the hostages were released and went back to their nations, you have the head of the Roman army who knows everything about the Huns. Now you have the head of the Hun army who knows everything about the Romans. Attila had a brother named Bledius. I think that was his name. Who helped him consolidate his rule over all the other Hunnic tribes. So after they had consolidated all the Hun tribes, guess what Attila did to his brother? The hallmark of the wolf is murder. The greatest enemy of the wolf is other wolves. Attila waged a series of wars against the Romans for loot. But there was one time in particular that I thought was notable. He was a master of deception, of disguise. He could make the Romans think that he had 500,000 men when he only had 10,000. He could make the Romans believe one thing when another thing was the truth. In this case, a Roman delegation came out to see Attila about a treaty, or maybe to buy him off so he wouldn't attack them. Now, Attila really didn't want to attack the Romans and lose a lot of men, because the Romans were deadly soldiers. The Roman soldier was a German. They were big, they were tough, they were mean. They were deadly soldiers. And he didn't want to tear up his army if he could help it. So this is what he did. He took 40 Roman prisoners. Now, that didn't cost anything, did it? Wasn't his, you know. He took these 40 Roman prisoners. And he had them put to death in the slowest, most awful way. He had them strung on trees, slowly being pulled to pieces, and their screams could be heard for half a mile away. And he took 20 of his most god-awful looking Huns and dressed them in evil-smelling old clothes skins and told the Romans that these were the leaders of the Huns. And Attila gave them raw meat to eat. And they were sitting around amidst these Roman prisoners who were dying horribly and impaled on stakes and being pulled to pieces on trees and screaming their life away. And into this little forest, these Huns were calmly chewing on raw meat with blood dripping down their chins. And the Romans in their silks and the Romans in their furs were ushered into the table and offered a seat, where Attila himself was eating a piece of raw meat. And he doubled the price. He said, in order for me not to invade the Roman Empire, I demand 2,000. And before this time, 1,000 was the greatest ransom ever offered for the Roman Empire. And it was accepted like that. The Romans paid. And for the sake of 40 lives, the Romans paid more money than they had ever paid in the history of the Roman Empire, just so this wouldn't happen to them. Now that is the work of a master actor. And you really have to admire a person who can pull that off. This was the type of man who led the Huns. He crossed on over into Europe and all on over into France. This is France. Because he heard that at a church there, at Troyes, there was treasure. The Catholic Church had gathered treasure from all over France, and there was enough money in that one church to pay all his horde of people. He had 1,000,000 people with him. Now let's say, tell you who he had with him, because this is important. The rule is, use an enemy to kill an enemy. Use an enemy to kill an enemy. He had the Ostrogoths bound to him by hostages and oaths. In France, there were the Franks. Now, you would think the Franks living in Roman France would fight for the Romans. But the Romans had really done a job on them. They taxed them. And in order to pay the taxes, they had to borrow money. And then they had to pay 11 back for every 10 they borrowed. The Franks were so deeply in debt that all were on the verge of losing their lands. Attila promised the Franks that if they would fight with him, that he would give them the land. It would be theirs. And he would only tax them a fraction of what they were being taxed. A person who lives on taxed land does not own his land. But they agreed to this because it was the best offer they had. So he took all the people living in France to fight for him. And then you have the Vandals. The Vandals were Germans trying to cross the river, the Rhine River, to get into France to occupy the deserted lands. What's wrong with occupying deserted lands? The Romans soldiers were told not to let them cross, so they didn't let them cross. The Vandals were open to any offer. Attila said, if you will fight for me, I will give you lands in France and only tax you just a little bit. So they agreed to fight for Attila the Hun. Attila arrived in France with 1,000,000 men. And who was to oppose him? The Romans and the Visigoths were deadly enemies. They had been fighting for a long time. But the Visigoths were deadly enemies with the Huns. So the Germans in the Roman legions made an agreement. with the East Germans to fight together. So you have the Visigoths and you have the Roman Germans fighting together at the great battle of the Catalonian fields. And the historians say that that was a day that the world will never, ever forget. Standing on a ridge, the two lines were separated by 1,000 yards. And the lines went as far as the eye could reach, with the flags up on one side, with the flags up on banners with the horse tails, and on the other side with the banners with the Christian cross on them. And as far as the eye could see, new units would come up. And as the new units would come into the lines would be pressed closer, closer, and closer, and closer, and closer, and closer, until finally the lines touched. And then when it touched, the war was on. The battle was on. And it was a battle to the death. Neither side gave back. The Germans, the Romans, and the Visigoths didn't step back one step. The Huns and their allies didn't back one step. From the time the sun came up in the morning until it set that night, the dead mounted. The people fighting on the lines looked like they were fighting on little hills. They were hills of bodies, bodies 10 and 20 deep. And that day, Attila lost 300,000 men. It's not recorded how many the Visigoths and the Romans lost. Theodoric, the great leader of the Visigoths, were killed. We know that. But we know that Attila had to retrace. He had to go back. He had to retreat and pull her to France. One of the German chieftains under him said, "I will no longer fight for you." And Attila had him put to death in a horrible manner. And in typical wolf fashion, Attila took that chieftain's daughter for his 300th wife. And he took her to bed. And the next morning, Attila was found in a pool of blood. She had killed him during the night. One of our women, one of our German women, did what all the knights, all the Visigoths, all the German service couldn't do. One of our women did. Now, what happens in a wolf pack when the wolf, leader of the wolves, dies? They immediately fight among themselves for superiority. What happened to the hunting? It disintegrated into warring wolves all over the place. They were fighting each other. They were fighting everyone. And that's the time we went to work and cleared the rest of the Huns out of Europe. It was that close. Now, this was the first time in recorded history that our people, the sheep, and the met. And it was a near, near thing. We met on the Catalonian fields in the fields of France. This was the first of the many invasions of the West. The fifth invasion is now underway. We will find a way in time to deal with this invasion. But I want to tell you just one thing, just real fast. And we have exactly how much time? 3 minutes. There was an Indian. His name was Geronimo. Geronimo was a magnificent warrior. He was a great Indian chief. He did what no other Indian chief had done before. He united all the tribes, Western tribes, into one great massive army. Geronimo killed in battle, and his confederation disintegrated. As the tribes fought among themselves, as they had always, as wolves always fight. Our kinsmen, the Germans, Dutch, and South Africa, were confronted with the Zulus. The Zulu army, great Zulu army, was coming down. There was only about 3,000 or 4,000 Boers to fight them. A commando was organized, a commando of 10 men on horses. They located the Zulu leader in the middle of his army. When night came, they started galloping. They galloped through the sleeping Zulu army right straight to the corral. You think that's a Western name? That comes from Africa. The corral, the surrounding where the Zulu chief was. They rode right up They killed him. And they galloped out to the other side. As they would gallop, the Zulus, warriors would awake. And the cries would be behind them. If any of the Boers' horses stepped in a chuck hole and it fell, they left him right behind. And they rode out the other side. And the Zulu invasion stopped dead as they fought for supremacy. Who is going to be the next pack leader? The wolves learn. They learn. And we learn. Today, we know who the other leaders of the great invasions were. We know who Genghis Khan was. We know who Muhammad and all the leaders of the Arabian armies were. But who is the leader of today's army? You don't know his name. And I don't know his name. He is hidden very carefully. He is hidden very carefully. They have learned. But he's there. And in time, he will make his presence known. The enemy is eager to destroy all who call upon the name of the Lord, but that when they discover their Lord, their days will be through. We are going to be confronted with days never seen before. These are the most exciting days in Christendom. This is the Second Reformation. The Bible is open, the teachings are clear, our shepherd's the way, and we're going to follow in his steps. That's our calling. Thank you so much.
The preceding message by circuit riding preacher Peter Peters from the LaPorte Church of Christ, located at the base of the beautiful Colorado Rocky Mountains in LaPorte, Colorado, has been aired on the Scripture for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network and is available on CD and is archived at the website scripturesforamerica.org. Remember, circuit rider, preacher, and teacher Peter Peters broadcasts live nightly from his Wyoming radio ranch, nestled in the Laramie, Wyoming River Valley. It's a working horse and cattle ranch where searcher Dr. Peters reaches the lost sheep of the House of Israel worldwide on satellite, internet, and shortwave radio. Dial settings 5755 and 9480. Check out the 24-hour, 7 days a week web broadcasting website, sfubn.com. Scriptures for America Worldwide Broadcasting Network is made possible by the prayers and tithes of the faithful. If you want to write to circuit riding preacher Peter Peters, the address is Scriptures for America, P.O. Box 766, LaPorte, Colorado, 80535. Or you can visit us on the web at www.scripturesforamerica.org. The preacher will be riding back this way next week and hopes you will too.